The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Restrictive lung disease is presented by Dr. Thomas Morley.
When I was training, we used to talk about interstitial lung diseases. And the notion was that the disease would start in the interstitium of the lung and gradually lead to fibrosis. Well, it basically is not that simple, and they kind of changed the term. Now they call it diffuse parenchymal lung disease. And my point today is to just do the broad topic of restrictive lung diseases. And the ones they usually test on for boards is lung fibrosis. So when we review things, I'm going to stress that in terms of your review. But other things can cause restriction as well. We talked about pulmonary function testing earlier. One of the ones is thoracic deformity. People have kyphoscoliosis or other forms of thoracic deformity. The lungs are smaller than they should be, but the lungs, if you biopsy, were pathologically normal. People have a massive pleural effusion, compresses the lung, causes atelectasis. We talked about respiratory muscle weakness, Guillain-Barré syndrome, or other kinds of diseases that cause the respiratory muscles to weak, but the lungs are structurally normal. Increased abdominal pressure can reduce lung volume, and certainly extrinsic compression of lung by chest wall factors, etc. Go back. Okay. So that we just mentioned that the term interstitial lung disease is basically a misnomer. Most of these diseases are not restricted to the interstitium of the lung, and they can actually go back and forth between the interstitium and the alveolar. For example, when somebody goes into a congestive heart failure, what happens is it's initially an interstitial disease. You get the lymphatics are involved. Then the lungs become involved in the alveolar filling, and finally, when you diuresis, it becomes interstitial again. That wasn't good. Spilled my water, sorry. So that interstitial lung disease is basically a kind of obsolete disease. And this is just the notion showing the interstitium of the lung. You can look at that. But really, for the board's purposes, what we're looking at is looking at for things that cause interstitial infiltrates or interstitial fibrosis. And there's probably about 130 different diseases that can cause that kind of interstitial diffuse parenchymal lung disease. And all of them, the things that put them together is they have diffuse pulmonary infiltrates, they have restrictive physiology when you do their breathing tests, and all of them have some distortion of the gas exchange area of the lung, either fibrosis, inflammation, bleeding into the segment, but there's some damage to the gas exchange units of the lung, and that's what leads to their clinical symptoms. The symptoms that they most frequently get are they get reduction or exercise tolerance, and often they can have a hypoxemia, where Dr. Vasoy was saying with COPDers, when they walk, sometimes their oxygen can drop. Characteristically, that happens in people that have pulmonary fibrosis. And oftentimes they'll have coughs, sometimes productive, most times not. Now, there's a very large number of things that cause diffuse parenchymal lung diseases, and we don't have time to talk about all of them. I'm going to try and talk about the ones that are both common and the ones that you're likely to get tested on in terms of the boards. One of the most common ones we see is sarcoid. I would be amazed if there's not some questions on sarcoidosis, so we'll spend a couple of minutes talking about that. One of the most common fibrosing lung conditions we see is idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. It's also called cryptogenic fibrosis and alveolitis. Other diseases, bronchiolitis, Blerian's organizing pneumonia, we now call that COP, or cryptogenic organizing pneumonia, lots of initials, lots of abbreviations. Lymphangitic spread, we won't really talk much about. I will talk a little bit about pneumoconiosis, because they may show you either test questions or x-rays about that. Drug-induced disease, always important to remember, because if you don't remember it, you'll forget to stop the drug that's causing it. And chronic eosinophil pneumonia, I'll show you some things. The rest of these, I'll mention some of the things. Langerhans cell, we'll talk a little bit about. Hypersensitive, we'll talk a little bit about, and we'll talk a little bit about all these. Now, It's difficult to talk about the It's difficult to talk about the pathogenesis of interstitial lung diseases because they're so diverse. There's no unifying theory for it. But in general, we inhale something. For example, like with pneumoconiosis, we'll inhale coal dust or silica dust. That dust sets up an inflammatory response within the lung. That inflammation recruits inflammatory cells into the lung, and the lung becomes damaged. And sometimes it becomes damaged. It goes on to fibrosis. If we can, we want to do something to prevent that fibrosis, depending on what the cause of the stimulus is. In other diseases, like good pastures and things like that, there's a blood-borne anti-glomerular basement membrane that causes damage to the alveolar capillary membrane. They get bleeding to the lung, and we do treat that. Now, when you have anybody that has an interstitial lung disease on their x-ray, there's certain things that you want to look at to try and narrow the list of possibilities. One is the duration of their symptoms. Some of these come on subacutely, some of them come on very slowly over long periods of time. Many of them have a very slow rate of progression. Some of them have a more acute rate of progression. Sometimes they'll have fever. Occasionally they'll have hemoptysis. But most importantly, many of these diseases are associated with extrapulmonary manifestations. The kidneys will be involved, or the lungs will be, the kidneys will be involved, the skin will be involved. And often, those extrapulmonary manifestations are big clues to help you to figure out what the cause of the disease is. Occupational exposure is very important, pneumoconiosis, inorganic antigens like hypersensitivity, drug-induced diseases we mentioned, occupational, and IV drug use all have to be sought out. Now, physical exam often is normal. They may have no abnormalities. Sometimes they'll have crackles, sometimes they'll have wheezes, occasionally they'll have pericardial or pleural friction rubs. But again, extrathoracic manifestations key. I'll stress it. Looking for adenopathy, skin involvement, prominent joint disease, CNS involvement, ocular involvement, all can clue you into the diagnosis. Specific diagnosis. Laboratory tests, most of these patients are going to get CBC, UA, creatinine, CRP, and I made a list, better list here. These are the tests that we look for systemic diseases that are associated with the inflammatory processes. I listed them there. The one that gets forgotten is the hypersensitivity pneumonitis. People are exposed to some organic antigen, it's not identified, and they have ongoing lung damage. Now, certain things on the x-ray, I'm going to show you some x-rays in a minute. When you look at an x-ray, there's all kinds of patterns you can get from. You can have a reticular pattern, nodular pattern, ground glass, mostly interstitial infiltrates they're called. The distribution in the lung can sometimes help you. Some diseases tend to be upper lobe. For example, silicosis, sarcoid, Langerhans cell, ankylosing spondylitis are almost invariably upper lobe diseases. Some diseases are rarely upper lobe or certainly more for predilection for the lower lobes. Idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, rheumatoid arthritis, asbestos, scleroderma, and Sjogren's all tend to have a lower lobe distribution. If you look for adenopathy, these diseases, basically the big two would be sarcoidosis and silica. Langerhans cell, it's the habit, but it's not very prominent. Nodules, sarcoid, rheumatoid, Wegener's, SLE, and Sjogren's all can have nodular patterns. And pleural involvement in most diseases tends to not be that prominent, with the exception of asbestosis, where you get pleural plaquing. Rheumatoid and lupus would be the ones that would have pleural disease. PFTs we'll talk about, they can be normal, but oftentimes they're going to show a restrictive defect. A tissue biopsy for many of these diseases is often necessary. Sometimes it's transbronchial, sometimes it's going to be by VATS. And often, if they have extrapulmonary manifestations, if they've got kidney involvement, biopsy their kidney. If they have skin involvement, biopsy their skin. Biopsy the site that's the least invasive for the patient. And a BAL gallium scan we hardly ever use anymore. Now, I talked about the rate of progression of symptoms, and that can be extremely helpful at times. Diseases like IPF, it's a disease that happens over 3 to 5 years. If somebody's having a disease that's progressing over 3 to 4 months, well, that's not IPF. Same thing with rheumatoid lung. Sarcoidosis can be either. It can be acute or chronic. It just depends on how it presents. Langerhans cell, granulomatosis or histiocytosis tends to be chronic, and pneumoconiosis is always chronic. All the pneumoconiosis, you have to have them for more than 25 years before you're going to see radiographic manifestation. So if you have somebody that has an acute presentation, it's not from a pneumoconiosis. On the other hand, some diseases are acute and subacute, like bronchiolitis obliterans or COP. I'll show you some slides about that. Drug-induced, I'll emphasize again, you have to always ask for it. Hypersensitivity is one of those common things that gets missed even by pulmonologists, and chemical exposures have to be identified. Now, and this is just a slide to kind of emphasize what I talked about before. If somebody has prominent nasal symptoms, Wagner's is, granulomatous polyangiitis, I should say, is a prominent feature with that. It's not prominent with most of the other ones. Rheumatoid arthritis, sarcoid, granulomatous vasculitis, and Sjogren's all have prominent arthritis. In fact, many people that have interstitial disease, they all look the same on the x-ray. It's really the extra, they don't come to you because of the interstitial zone disease. They come because of the arthritis or the skin involvement or other things, so they have to think about that. Skin involvement, you can read. And again, same thing. Looking at the different disease states or the extra pulmonary manifestations can limit that differential diagnosis and make it a lot easier for you to come up with a specific diagnosis. Now, I want to spend a couple of minutes talking about different cases that some of which you're likely to see and some of which the x-rays are likely to be on boards. And this would be a typical case. A 34-year-old black female presents with 6 months of a cough and non-productive cough and dyspnea with exertion. She's on no medications, she just has no IV drug use history, no occupational exposures, and no systemic signs or symptoms. And this would be the x-ray. So what's the x-ray show? This would be fair game for boards. It's just bilateral hilar adenopathy. This is a typical x-ray that you would see with stage one sarcoid. All right. And this again, sarcoidosis, is a big, bulky hilar adenopathy, prominent right paratracheal adenopathy. The lungs look relatively clear, and that would be consistent with radiographic stage one sarcoid. Okay. When you look at sarcoidosis, there's three or four stages we talk about. They can have a normal chest x-ray, but that's unusual. The most common one you'll see is that they just have bilateral hilar and paratracheal adenopathy. Fair game on the exam. They could show you that on the exam, and you'd be expected to identify it. You can have radiographic two sarcoidosis that you have bilateral hilar adenopathy and parenchymal lung involvement. That's about 30% of cases. You can only have patients that only have lung involvement. That's radiographic stage three. And radiographic stage four is when it's fibrotic. The disease is no longer active. Good. So what I just showed you was was radiographic stage one sarcoid. What's different about this one? Talking about the interstitium. Of the lung itself. Does the lung look involved? Yes, lung's definitely involved. Here you have bilateral hilar adenopathy. You also have paratracheal adenopathy. But now if you look at the lung in the interspaces, it looks like there's a fine interstitial nodular infiltrate really in the lungs. And if you look carefully, it looks like it's mostly in the upper lobe. And the way that you tell that, got this all wet, sorry. So if you look at the costophrenic angles, in people that have upper lobe disease, the costophrenic angles are spared. If the costophrenic angles are involved, that means you have both upper and lower lobe, or at least have lower lobe disease. And this is the person after two years after treatment. You can see that now that most of that interstitial disease the patient had was resolved. They still have pretty prominent adenopathy, but fairly dramatic resolution in the interstitial disease. And that's where I talked at the beginning. What we want to do with these diseases, if they're treatable, treat them early to prevent them from going on to fibrosis. And sarcoid is a good example of how you can, one of the diseases you can do that with. This is a stage three sarcoidosis. This person has just multiple pulmonary nodules, nodular sarcoidosis, and not really much adenopathy at all. So this would be the typical kind of person that you would see with radiographic stage three sarcoid. Now, sarcoidosis, just in what other things they might ask you, it's a multi-system disease, but 94% of the time it affects the lung. It occurs in younger patients, usually second and third decades of life. More prevalent in blacks, but certainly Caucasian populations were involved with it as well. We don't do gallium scanning anymore. Lab tests are nonspecific. At the ACE level, angiotensin converting enzyme, it can tell us that the disease is active, but doesn't really predict who's going to need treatment or respond to treatment. Hypercalcemia can occur, hypercalciuria can occur, and hypergammaglobulinemia occurs in about 70% of patients. Anergy occurs in about 50% of these patients. And a diagnosis can be made generally by transbronchial lung biopsy. You would think that stage one sarcoid, if you did a transbronchial biopsy, the yield is low, it would be poor. In point of fact, it's about 65%. Once they get parenchymal lung involvement, the transbronchial lung biopsy goes up fairly dramatically. So, and again, treatment is steroids, methotrexate, plaquenil, a bunch of things, but it's unlikely they're going to ask you about treatment. And this is when this would be a fair game for a slide to show pathology to describe a case that sounds like sarcoid and show you multiple non-caseating granulomas. There's no necrosis. You can see molding nucleated giant cells, and this would be a typical, if they showed you for a biopsy, what sarcoid would look like. All right, now, in order to make the diagnosis of sarcoidosis, you have to have three elements. One is you have to have a compatible clinical picture. On biopsy, you want to have non-casein granulomas, and you also want to make sure you don't have infections. TB, fungal infections can also cause non-casein granuloma, and you want to make sure that you don't have an infection that you're missing and not treating. Now, another case, this is a 60-year-old weight male, severe exertional distance over 3 or 4 months, non-productive cough, may have had a virus, he's not 100% sure prior to his symptoms, non-smoker, no medications, no exposures, no high-risk behaviors. You examine him, he's got digital clubbing and he's got crackles. Okay, and this would be a typical x-ray. You see mostly lower limb. Here, you look at this particular x-ray, if you look at the costophrenic angles, you can see there's increased interstitial markings in the angles, which tells you that this is a lower lobe disease prominently. You can also see that there's these prominent interstitial markings in both lungs. And if you look at the lung volume, what do you think of the overall lung volume here? It's low, exactly right. So they, when, just like when we look at a COPD, or we see that the lungs are elevated, or hyperinflated. The people that have pulmonary fibrosis, the lungs physically get smaller. And when you look at the x-ray, the lungs will physically look smaller. When you do your spirometry, the spirometry will show you that they have restrictive lung disease. Now, this is a person that has the typical idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, very common and unfortunately very devastating disease. Build my water. In these patients, they tend to be older. We said sarcoid, they tend to be younger. Patients with IPF, they tend to be older. Generally greater than 60 years old at the time of presentation. Slight male predominance, and characteristically has a slow progression. These disease does not rapidly. Mostly it says over 2 years. Mostly it's over 3 to 5 years as the disease progresses. It's fairly relentless, and it's not a good disease to have. Symptoms are usually dyspnea. Dyspnea is the most prominent symptom, cough, sometimes bad. And clubbing occurs in a fairly high percentage. So if you see an older patient, slowly progressive disease with digital clubbing, and that x-ray, it virtually confirms the diagnosis. This is just looking at the incidence of prevalence and what it's basically showing you in both males and females. The incidence of prevalence both increase over time. There's a slight male predominance. And again, most age of onset is usually between 40 and 70 years. Okay, now, this is a pathologic specimen. One of the things these patients get is what they get the fibrosis. They get areas of honeycombing that in between the areas of pulmonary fibrosis, they form these cysts that really have no alveoli in them. And it's basically destroyed lung is essentially what it boils down to. And when you see honeycombing, it tells you the disease is old, that you don't get honeycombing acutely. It occurs chronically. The treatment for IPF for years was terrible. It still has a bad 5-year mortality, about 50%. Worse than that, 10% of these patients will end up with bronchogenic carcinoma. In fact, many diseases that cause pulmonary fibrosis can also be associated with late development of bronchogenic carcinoma. It's called a scar carcinoma. The two new agents, OFEV and pirfenidone, or Esprit spelled wrong, but the, should have caught that. Both of these agents are newer agents that do have some efficacy. But what I would emphasize is that when you put them on these agents, you don't expect to get improvement in their lung function. That's not what happens. Usually what happens, you just prevent the disease from progressing. So you want to treat them early. So x-ray with idiopathic, this is another thing that I might show you, is that the x-ray usually shows bilateral reticular or reticular nodular changes and always in a lower lobe distribution. If you look at high resolution CT, the fibrosis is usually subpleural, right underneath the edge of the lung. The labs, there's no specific labs. In fact, IPF is one of the diseases that it has no extra pulmonary manifestation. So if somebody's got prominent other complaints outside the chest, you want to think it's probably not idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. Classically, you need lung biopsy for to make the diagnosis. But what's the problem with lung biopsy? Now, these patients are old, they have lots of comorbid diseases, and it's difficult sometimes to put somebody through a lung biopsy. I have two patients right now that are on treatment that they're 80, one's 82, one's 85. They're horrible candidates for a VATS procedure, so I'm just treating them empirically. How can we make the diagnosis? Well, generally, the CAT scan they show you on the top, you can see that there's subpleural interstitial disease, there's some areas of honeycombing in there, mostly here and here. And when you look at their lungs, they've got prominent honeycomb changes on the biopsy. Now, you don't have to read this slide, but the point of this slide is that what I just said is that many patients with IPF are not good candidates for open lung biopsy. So what they did was they tried to come up with a clinical characteristics for patients that we think have IPF so that we could avoid lung biopsy. And they have the major criteria and the minor criteria on the right. If they have all the major criteria and three of the minor criteria, there's no need for biopsy in those patients. You could just, they have the disease and you really don't need to do anything more than that about it. They're not going to ask you any of them, I don't think. Now, this is classically what IPF would look like, particularly early in the disease, where you have subpleural fibrosis, mostly lower lobe. And this is what it looks like on the biopsy. And here, we were talking initially about the disruption of the histologic portion of the air-bearing portion of the lung. And here, you really don't even see any alveoli anymore. All you have is inflammation of the lung. If you do a trichome stain of the lung, all you see is collagen factors. It's just all full of collagen now that's replaced the normal lung. Okay, so sarcoid and IPF are fair game. That would be very fair targets for you on the exam, both looking at mostly at radiographic and or pathologic information in the case-based fashion. Next case I want to talk about, this is an interesting case. 43-year-old female presented with 2 months of fever, cough, dyspnea, and weight loss. And there's no medications, she was a mild smoker, no occupational exposure, no risk factors, and presented really more like an infection, had a low-grade temp, crackles on exam, upper lobe distribution toward a disease. And this is not her, but this is a very similar case. And this is a distal alveolar pattern that you see within the lung. It's called a reverse bat wing, where you see upper lobe alveolar infiltrates bilaterally. And this is a good example of what they look like. And it's called a reverse bat wing. A bat wing is when people have heart failure, the hilum fills up with fluid and then it progresses outward. And this is the reverse bat wing, where the infiltrates are in the periphery of the lung and then come more centrally. And when we did a biopsy here on the patient, she had just eosinophils all over the place. So this is chronic eosinophilic pneumonia. In fact, we did a bronchoalveolar lavage in this lady, and she had profound eosinophilia on her bronchoalveolar lavage. When we did a blood count on her, she had peripheral eosinophilia in her blood. So this is a classic case of chronic eosinophilic pneumonia. And for testing purposes, this is what they usually show you. They show you this peripheral alveolar infiltrates within the lung. It's called reverse bat wing. So that if they show you that, tell you the person has eosinophilia, the diagnosis is chronic eosinophilic pneumonia. This is another example from the literature. And again, sometimes the one I showed you was absolutely classic. This is not so classic. This one looks more peripheral. This one's more central. So sometimes people don't read the books. They don't have a classic x-ray. But if they test you, they'll show you this x-ray. This is the classic one. All right, now, so chronic eosinophilic pneumonia, it peaks in the third decade, 2-to-1 female to male predominance. Subacute presentation, many of these patients are treated for pneumonia, it doesn't get better, they get another treatment for pneumonia, and then they get referred for evaluation. Often presents like fever. I mean, they present cough, fever, dyspnea. The one lady that we had years ago, I thought she had TB. I put her into the thing, and then we got a peripheral eosinophilia was like 30%, then we did a lavage and biopsies. And so again, they're often treated for pneumonia first. Again, the peripheral distribution, the reverse bat wing, blood, biopsy, BAL, all can have profound eosinophilia. The nicest thing about this disease is it responds dramatically to steroids. The lady, the first case of it I had, she had been sick for months. I mean, she really felt quite badly. We put her on steroids, and within a couple of weeks, she felt tremendously better. Her x-ray got better. The only caveat I would say is that when you, if you treat this disease, you have to treat them for at least 6 months. And often when you stop the steroids, the infiltrates will come back. There we go. Now, there's, if you look at the review articles, there's probably about 200 medications that have lung damage associated with them. We're not going to go over all or any of them, really. But the important thing is anybody that has any infiltrates, whether they're acute infiltrates, chronic infiltrates, interstitial, alveolar, whatever, you always want to get a history of what medications they're on. If you don't know that they're on a medication that causes damage to the lung, you're not going to stop it, and they're going to have ongoing lung damage. So it seems like a silly thing, but oftentimes we get distracted by other, you know, things when we're examining people and doing our H&Ps, and that's one of the most important. Always look at the medications to find out what could cause damage. Another thing, people that have collagen vascular disease, as I mentioned before, they'll come in with interstitial infiltrates within their lung, but what they're there for is not because of it. They have joint pains, arthritis, they got sclerodactyly, they got esophagitis, they got things, they got muscle pains, you know, they got pleural disease. All the diseases that outside, the, or I should say, diseases that are extrapulmonary, and it's really that's what they come to you for. They really don't come because of interstitial disease. You find it, but what you really want to concentrate on is the extrapulmonary manifestations to make a specific diagnosis. And this would be another person with pulmonary fibrosis. Is it upper lobe, lower lobe, or both? It's lower lobe. If you look here, look at the costophrenic angles. You can see the disease completely obliterates the costophrenic angles. So that when you see that, that's lower lobe disease, okay? And you can see also, if you look at the degree of inspiration the person has, the lungs look smaller. They're smaller than they should be, and that's because of the pulmonary fibrosis, particularly on the right. Another case, we have a 47-year-old homosexual male, 11-month history of non-productive cough, fever, sweats, chills, wheezing, had a 35 profound weight loss, and his exam, he had fever, had basilar crackles, he had no clubbing. And I don't have the gentleman's x-ray, I would like to show you. Poo. All right, well, sorry. But this gentleman, when we looked at him, he had what looked like two, almost looked like abscesses in his upper lobe. One was pretty big, one was pretty small. He got treated with everything in his mother. Make a long story short, we sent him for biopsy, and he had cryptogenic organizing pneumonia. And and he also had AIDS. We documented that he had AIDS. And at that time, when we initially diagnosed, it wasn't as clear that patients that had cryptogenic organized pneumonia responded to steroids. He responded to steroids, did very well, in spite of the fact that he had HIV. He responded to steroids quite well, didn't aggravate his infections at all. So cryptogenic organized pneumonia, or BOOP, can cause anything. It can have subpleural infiltrates, it can have masses, they can be upper lobe, they can be lower lobe. There's really anything can be associated with the radiographically can be associated with BOOP. Or the pathology. And this is just showing you a slide. A lot of patients, almost half of the patients, are going to be idiopathic. A fairly large number are going to be viral, drug-induced, inhaled gases, toxins, transplant, and HIV gets added to the list as well. The characteristics of cryptogenic organized pneumonia is that they have patchy bilateral, I should say they have patchy mixed interstitial alveolar infiltrates. They do not improve following antibiotics, fourth to sixth decade in terms of when they present. And generally they present subacutely. It's not like the 3 years, 5 years. It's, you know, two weeks, 2 months, that kind of stuff in terms of their symptom onset and duration. Symptoms are non-specific, but they act like they're infected. They have myalgias, cough, they feel lousy, they have headache and malaise. Again, x-ray can be anything. Pathology is important, though. The pathology of cryptogenic organizing pneumonia is they get fibroproliferative plugs in these small areas, the 2 millimeter or smaller airways. They also get what are called foamy macrophages, which are not characteristic. Open lung biopsy is usually not necessary. You can make it by transbronchial lung biopsy. And again, the nice thing about this disease, it's generally steroid responsive, but it's very similar to chronic eosinophilic pneumonia. You have to maintain the steroids for long periods of time, usually at least three to 6 months. Again, recurrences are common when you stop the steroids. All right. there's a couple of cases. This is a patient who was a sad case. A 53-year-old male had dyspnea over a year. He had some cough, yellow sputum production, heavy smoker, and he worked as a tombstone engraver. What he did was he would sit in a small room that had no ventilation, smoke his cigarettes, and carve his tombstones. And he had diminished breast sounds and digital clubbing. And this is what his x-ray looked like. You can see these small areas of nodules within the lung. And then you have these big areas of fibrosis. It's called progressive massive fibrosis. It can occur with anthracosis, it can occur with silicosis. This particular patient had anthracosis, but the patient I described had an x-ray that was almost exactly similar to this. And here you can see the big masses associated. So that, that's been, and this is what more commonly with silica and anthracosis do. They have these kind of a miliary pattern of macules from the silica. With progressive massive fibrosis from silicosis, they can often cavitate, and sometimes they're even infected with TB. This is just more what they usually look like, these fine miliary pattern, mostly throughout the, and you can see the costophrenic angles are spared. Another thing with you can get with silicosis is eggshell calcifications, where the rim of the lymph node is surrounded by calcium. Sarcoid and silica are the two things that will do that for testing purposes. This is just more of the same, the macules that you get with it. The big three for pneumoconiosis, asbestos, anthracosis, and silica, all of them have a long gap from the time of exposure to the time they develop disease. Asbestos tends to be lower lobe and is associated with pleural plaques. Silicosis and anthracosis tend to be upper lobe, and if they have calcified adenopathy, it's going to usually be silica. Oops. Now, these are just pleural plaques. These are dense pleural plaques from somebody that has asbestos exposure. In spite of the fact that they look terrible, they don't affect the person's breathing. They don't cause restriction. When people have asbestosis, what that means is they get fibrosis of the lung, and that does cause them to have the dyspnea and disability. And this is just more of the same, more of the plaques here you can see on the right and the left. This is what they look like on CAT scan. They're called boxcar plaques, and you can see these particular ones are calcified. All right, last couple of slides I want to just make a point about. I don't think that they're going to ask you much about hypersensitivity on the exam, but I'll mention a couple of things. Usually they present with infections, they're treated a couple of times with antibiotics, and nobody knows what's going on. But what causes the hypersensitivity pneumonitis is that they breathe in an antigen that their organic antigen that the body reacts to. They do immune complex injury, which can cause the person to have acute infiltrates to the lung. They also get type 4, delayed hypersensitivity, and sometimes when people that have hypersensitivity, you will see small granulomas, not like sarcoid where they're all over the place, but in small individual poorly formed granulomas. And again, another thing that causes foamy histiocytes. This is an example of hypersensitivity, and here you can see a fairly well-formed granuloma, non-casein granuloma, so you might confuse it with other diseases. Last thing I want to mention about is the Langerhans cell granulomatosis. The only thing I think they might ask you about that is this. When it's usually a young person presents with upper lobe nodules and cysts, again, is the lower lobe involved here? No, thank you. Now, once you learn to look at it, you can see clearly there's no involvement of the costophrenic angle, so that if you're looking to see whether something's upper or lower and you only have an x-ray, that's how you tell, okay? The thing that's also interesting about Langerhans cell is that it's not associated with VIMOS. All the other ones I talked to you about that cause fibrosis, the lungs got smaller. With this disease, it does not get smaller. The cysts make the lung bigger, the nodules make it smaller, and the net effect is that on the x-ray, it looks pretty much normal. But upper lobe, younger patients. And it's what it looks like on CAT scan, cysts and nodules. On this one, you can see the cysts are fairly prominent, the nodules are not so prominent. This one, you can see the nodules are fairly prominent, the cysts are not as prominent, but the combination of cysts and nodules without VIMOS. And this is just the clinical case, we don't really need to talk about it. Good. Oh, the other thing I want to mention today. The other thing that you can get with Langerhans cell, in addition to young age and the cysts and nodules, no VIMOS, is they can about 10% of patients will present with pneumothorax, so that may be a clue.